Hello, you're listening to Freifunk Radio. Today we're doing a pre-recording with Dylan Reibling. He's here in Berlin to shoot a documentary about distributed networks or decentralized networks. He's nodding at us. You won't hear him nodding.
Yeah. No, sorry. It's a documentary habit because I never want to hear my voice on the track, so I always nod in agreement with everybody.
Yeah. But you're now in an interview situation where I'm going to interview you as a revenge from you interviewing me for a long time yesterday. So Dylan, of course, it's our Freifunk broadcast, podcast that we do. We usually do live broadcast. It's number 105 when we broadcast it. It's going to be broadcasted in December because we did a live broadcast today. Without any further ado, let's talk about the work that you are both doing at the moment. So you're traveling around the world. You did some research on distributed networks, and is that accurate?
Yeah, it's been sort of a long journey for me to actually get to the point where I'm actually producing this documentary. It started off, if you can believe it, back in 2017. I was at a hacker conference in Prague, and it was right before, so 2017, if you can remember, it was right before Bitcoin hit 20,000 for the first time. So in those heady, frothy days, there was a lot of excitement around cryptocurrencies, and people were it was the height of the initial coin offering boom. So there was a lot of attention and excitement around that. And I had just finished working on a TV show about cybersecurity. So I was interested in sort of like what people were using cryptocurrencies for. And so at this conference, I was trying to figure out, you know, what are some of the interesting stories? What are people doing? And someone pulled me aside at the conference and said, "Listen, I know the cryptocurrency story is really interesting, but that's not the real story. That's not the technology that's going to impact the future. It's going to be the decentralized web." I was like, "Okay, so this sounds interesting." And this is back in 2017. I went to the web and started doing research, and there was nothing. There was nothing out there about decentralization. Maybe there was a little bit about mesh networks, and I had known a little bit about mesh networks from the TV show that I worked on, but very little about the decentralized web.
May I ask, what was the name of the TV show that you did?
It was called Cyber War. So
Cyber War.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was about national security and hacking, basically. Mm-hmm. So I did an episode about Stuxnet, which was the worm created by the Americans and the Israelis to attack Iranian nuclear centrifuges. I did an episode on sort of vulnerabilities in the Internet of Things and botnets. So I did a series of, like, you know, the intersection between hacking and geopolitics, basically.
I noticed that you're using the words decentralization, and yeah, you're more likely to use the word decentralization rather than distributed. But mesh networks in the strictest sense, if you want it, then it's actually a distributed network. But you're looking like you're interested in the social aspects that from centralized hierarchical structures people are trying to get away with regards to money, like if we don't see Bitcoin as a Ponzi scheme like some people do, and other people are looking for privacy. And these are probably the aspects that you're looking for also in your film, right?
Yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is There's lots of new interesting technology out there. For me, and I think for broader audiences, like I know the people like at Seabase or in hacker spaces and stuff, they're really interested in the nuts and bolts of how things work. But I think a lot of people, like broader audiences, people who don't consider themselves technical, are also impacted by technologies. And so sort of the thesis of my film is, you know, with the introduction of new technologies, what are the social, political, cultural, economic, you know, ramifications of new technologies? And so I'm hoping over the course of the film to find these stories where new technologies reveal their impact on the world in a way that's like tangible and not just necessarily abstract, you know? There's lots of really good, strong technical work with a lot of amazing potential, but finding, you know, where the rubber meets the road, you know, like where the thing comes into being in the real world is tricky.
Where is the actual impact in the world? You wanna be on that touching point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you expect that like decentralization, or which is not the same, like distributed communication systems or systems, are going to be disruptive in the future, politically, for the society? Is this something you expect?
That's actually a really open question for me, because a lot of people are putting a lot of time, effort, and brain power towards solving some of these problems, especially in the decentralized world. But like whether they can overcome the forces of capitalism is another question. Really, like that's the thing that I've found out, like, or I run into, is that, you know, centralized corporations like scale up really well, and monopolies make a lot of money. Decentralized or distributed models, it's a lot more difficult to make money, and I don't think that's where their value is or where their worth is, but it's just really hard for like a distributed network to compete on the same level as like a money making centralized network. And how that seems to, in all the people that I've been talking to, all the research I've been doing, people have a really difficult time sustaining distributed networks. And in fact, that's what brought me to Freifunk, is that people around the world talk about it as a sustainable community, as a tool that has like sustained stewardship over a long period of time in a way that, you know, has accomplished something that a lot of people want to accomplish around the world, but it's very difficult.
Yeah, but this is also like the perspective that people take from the outside. We have had many ups and downs, and for example, Freifunk in Germany grew a lot because we have some really fucked up legislation here with regards to copyright and people sharing internet access with other people. So we had this idea to build like a distributed infrastructure that is owned by the users, so they can help themselves in situations where, unfortunately, it's true to say about Germany, it's one of the worst countries with regards to internet access to the common people in Europe, where people are looking for helping themselves and getting available bandwidth. So, which shows how beautiful such an approach could be, that people help themselves if they have the right tools to make that. But after all, most networks, we always were hoping for services, local services, that would be like a deal breaker, like a groundbreaking. But most people, they consider such a local network just a subset of the big network. And the law of the network effects has it that if you can communicate at the same time or potentially with like 4 billion people rather than like 50 or 200 in your community, there needs to be something special, something really localized, something fascinating about being local and being limited to that little circle of neighbors, for example. But so far, we have not been so really successful in coming up with such a splendid idea that people start, something like a local blackboard, you know? But if you can do it also the other way around from the internet, you can just limit it to a certain geolocation and only show it to users in a certain area. So you can still do it top down by making an artificial limit, not by the limitation of the network itself.
Yeah, and maybe it's different that every few years the users of Freifunk, or the people who make Freifunk, change. You have all the ups and downs of community projects. People are coming, people are going, and so on. So Freifunk as of now is not the same as Freifunk was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So it's always totally different, but it's good to hear that others see Freifunk as a big picture somehow, as that we can show others that it's still working as a community, and we also have a lot of members in our communities that are here for 10 years, 20 years now. 2 weeks ago we had a celebration of 20 years of Freifunk meetings in Berlin, so that's a really long time we are here and doing stuff. And
yeah, which was actually the incubator where the Freifunk movement really took off. That there was the place, the sea base, and this regular gathering where you casually over a beer could find other people that were like-minded, like being artists, having a social approach to society, being libertarian, not in the sense of a capitalist libertarianism, but libertarian in the sense of a more egalitarian and more just society. And the motivations why people join Freifunk, they're so different. Some people are just excited about this open source software, about radio communication. You know, unlike ham radio, which is limited in what you can communicate, Freifunk is really free. You can communicate whatever you want. You're not restricted by regulations. Well, of course, certain regulations apply, like some stuff that is under criminal punishment. Of course, this is not, it's not different than to the ham radio guys that are only allowed to talk about the technology that they're using and the communications that they have. So they can only talk like Mita or like about electronics. So they're not able to say, they're not even allowed to share a message from a neighbor and send it to another guy somewhere else via another ham radio as a relay. You know, something which is totally essential to us, but this is regulated in ham radio. They might not all be very strict in following those rules, but in principle, in ham radio, you can just play with electronics. If you're fascinated about building antennas and electronics and so on, then it's something that's very interesting. Actually, I come from the side of being enthusiastic about radio technology, but the social component of sharing and enabling people to around the world to communicate, that's not part of ham radio, actually. But other people, they're like, they want to help people that are poor. They want to help people that are outcasts in the society. So there's, other motivations that you might think of, Andy?
We have, I think of Bluse, for example, who has a network over his villages nearby. There are a group of three or four villages, and they have some information boards, for example, in their village and using it. And they really play around with all that technology they can use, and it's really interesting what they do there. But this is some other kind of community we don't have in Berlin. It's the community of some villages that they are very strong in family and so on, and doing stuff together.
But they use the technology, and Bluesa is also active in developing the technology further. They used this DIY technology and in order to help themselves in an area that is not really connected. It's only recently that they can hope that they can get fiber there. So,
but now they have their own fiber in the village.
So
So there's a couple of things that you guys were talking about that I think are really interesting about peer-to-peer networks rather than the internet. And I feel like I think every generation is different. And I think there is going to be room for like younger people who are interested in more, I don't want to say curated, but a more exclusive. I mean, some people talk about the cozy web, like the small niche communities where they know everybody, and there's more of a, like a social understanding for talking freely amongst themselves about, inside jokes and stuff like that has like a standard across their community, like an inside group, and increasingly like teens have anonymous burner Instagram accounts, right? Where, like Finsta accounts where no one knows who they are, and they run it for a couple months and then they burn it down and they start over again. And I think some aspects like that of how we connect with each other, I think the internet that we have is not always going to be the internet that people want. And someone early on in my research process was telling me, he was like, what do we want? Like, people think we want the internet as it is right now, but sometimes what we just want is connectivity. And that can be peer-to-peer, that could be in small groups, that could be in cozy niche, like distributed communities rather than decentralized communities. Like, I think there's a lot of different kinds of internet that we can have and different kinds of connectivity that we can have.
Yeah. There's just, it's also about a certain quote-unquote mentality. Like, most people are like, shut up and take my money and deliver me a service. I want to pay for it. And of course, this approach fails if you're living in an area where it's not economically feasible or attractive for a corporation to give you internet access. So if you're living at a long tail of economics, then helping yourself is a necessity. So you have to do that. And then it's great that you can find some tools. And then you see some examples, and you can set up that network, or you set it up for other people. I was really, really amazed when I came to South Africa, and came to the Cape, to the Southern Cape, and I was in a township, and a guy that I met, Antoine van Gelder, he had set up a Freifunk network using the Freifunk boxes that we had hacked here in Berlin. He was using Sven Ola's Freifunk firmware on a Linksys WT54G, so they were distributed in that township. And this was like, traveling so far and then seeing that these ideas that we have been working on actually have an impact on real people's lives. That was really cool. So I thought, hey, I should make a documentary, travel around the world and find such locations and film them and see what people do with it. And you're actually doing that right now.
I mean, it's tough because the world is so big and there's so much. Yeah, it's like you can just even feel with that just story right there. It's like that's a huge change for a community, and it's a great example. But like, and there are examples like this all over the world. So, I you should do some research and sort of find out or tell me like what are all the tendrils that where has Freifunk found itself around the world.
Well, this is like a moving target, you know. Those networks, they might appear and they might go down, or they might thrive. And also the Freifunk movement, I guess it's also what has inspired the phone network. You might have heard about it. After Freifunk was quite popular back then already, or the idea of community networks as such. It's not only Freifunk, you know, this is like open community network idea of setting up your own networks. It's something that other people have been doing in the United States. There was the Champaign or Urbana network, which is like dates back like almost 20 years ago. It was also like pretty much at the beginning of it. And the Radlos Ost, the people in hackers in Amsterdam that did the same thing, like the people here in Berlin back then. But these networks, they inspire people to do other things, to try to make a business model out of it, which was the case of Phone. Phone had this idea, instead of becoming a person running Freifunk and using Freifunk for yourself and using other people's Freifunk, they wanted to commercialize that. So when you could buy a cheap router from them, and with the phone firmware inside, and then you were a Phonero, and as a Phonero you could use the hotspots of other Phonero users. But if you were not a part of the Phonero system, then you had to pay for it, and the people running those Phonero hotspots, they would actually get a share of the revenue that the phone would make with it. This was like this model. Sounded quite similar, but with some venture capital idea behind. And actually, I think somebody invested in it. It was like more than 20 millions that they invested in it. And what the outcome is that now we have like companies that sell wireless hotspots because they put this Phonero software that they had on those Phonero routers, where you have a public hotspot that people have to pay for using, and a private hotspot on the same router. And this is something that for now German Telekom does. So if you have subscribed to German Telekom, the technology that it didn't work from the phone model, but it worked for the telecom model. So this was also commercialized. But at the same time, there's hardly any open hotspots today. Yeah, there's hotspots, but then you need to register and you have to pay, and they make good money out of it.
Hmm. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's really hard to excite people doing networks on their own or creating their own networks. We tried to start some projects in centers for teens, and it was hard to find any of them to take part in the workshops and so on, set up their own routers. And I think it was hard to explain our idea, and maybe it's too cheap to get internet via your mobile phone, so they don't have to think about it, and they can have their Instagram, they can have their other social networks using it, and so this is something we lack in Freifunk, that we can excite people that are not in the technical stuff or deep into technical stuff and to engage there.
I mean, it's something. A couple of years ago, I was at a conference all about content moderation, and the people who organized the conference brought together a lot of academics, and they brought together a lot of activists, and they brought a bunch of artists together. And one of the artists was actually from Berlin, Matthias Judd. It was this, there's this duo Wachter and Judd, and they had gotten quite a bit of fame because they had created this installation called Can You Hear Me? On the Swiss Embassy. Mm-hmm. Do you guys know the project?
We know him, yes.
So he presented like a talk about Can You Hear Me? Which is like an art project about surveillance. Mm-hmm. And then he also ran a workshop on just running your own personal server, or running your own node. And so I went to the workshop, and sort of the most surreal thing happened. I was in a room full of like academics and technologists and activists and artists, all people concerned about content moderation. And he just ran through a quick little demo of like, here, connect to my node. I've got some like text and stuff on there, just some fun little Easter eggs and some hidden little documents and texts, and you guys can kind of communicate here. And this table full of people who are like high caliber, really thoughtful, you know, engaged individuals, everyone was like super giddy about like sending each other messages and stuff like that. And I do think there is something about that sort of level of connectivity that's still like, we still like, and there's still room for like novel, you know, interventions or novel kinds of connections that can be made through those roads. And, you know, like, let's hope someone finds a way to like, you know, like leverage that excitement about like intimate or secret connections, you know, like,
well, or a connection at all if your government tries to kill all your communications because there is a revolution going on or a dictatorship is throwing over your society. And this is something Matthias has a project called Call. It's spelled Q-U-A-L. So
Q-A-U-L. Q-A-U-L.
Q-A-U-L? Okay, I'm sorry. And this is, he started using the optimized link state routing protocol that we were hacking on here in Berlin, and using that protocol in order to build a distributed system of communication where you were able to, or you are able to chat spontaneously. Yeah.
Amazing. I'm hoping to interview him before I leave.
Yeah, you should. He lives in Berlin, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left until we run out of time.
Okay, what else did I want to tell you guys? This is the question. It's tough. The challenge has been like I bit off maybe more than I can chew by looking at internet infrastructure and this new movement of decentralization. Because like a lot of things since I started doing my research have sort of come into this world. There's blockchain, there's Web 3.0, like all these things, and there's so many different approaches and so many different people doing different things. So yeah, it's like, what else do I want to tell you? Maybe we're gonna have to do another show.
We won half an hour, and
and I imagine you guys like
and then we were good.
Oh no, I'm making a film. I got to keep people engaged for an hour and a half. What am I going to do?
Well, you did that with me yesterday, so so this time. And you guys, I guess at one point you also need some sleep.
One day we'll get some sleep.
Before you climbed some more towers tomorrow or whatever.
Oh, man. Well, it was great. Well, because we went to that node in Segenkirche?
Segenkirche.
Segenkirche, sorry, my pronunciation.
No, it's just you have a different way of pronunciation. I can just, Matthias Jud. Ah, is his name? Oh. And the church is Segenskirche. But you know, this is just like, yeah.
But yeah, so we went to the church and we climbed up and we adjusted some nodes, and it was just like a really fascinating, number one, because like the network itself, like the precision with which they tuned the antennas was very visceral, and you could see it happen, and it was, and they were doing it live, and there was a lot of satisfaction in seeing them like fine tune.
Oh yes, it is. It is like a, you have to consider like when you have like very strong directional equipment or antennas, then you have to aim from both sides, and you have, yeah, it's like shooting, but shooting very precise. It's like firing a bullet from one barrel and trying to hit the muzzle of another barrel on the other side, several kilometers away. It's not quite like this, but this is, of course, is an exaggeration, but like at an opening angle of less than 1 degree, then aiming, and you can be too high, too low, and you can also twist it, rotate device a bit, so the it's still again a little bit out of phase, and this all needs to be adjusted.
I mean, for me, it's like so much of this world that I'm exploring is abstract and sort of in the realm of thought and idea. So to actually see like people adjusting a router and like like doing that fine precision work was like, it exists, it's real.
You maybe missed the people from 6 years ago from Slovenia. They had a laser technology, and so you could see the lasers pointing at each other, and so they adjusted their links via laser light.
Yeah, and then you have to take into account that when the temperature changes, your adjustment of your light beam changes. So you need some electronics that automatically recorrects the link.
So now you're telling me I gotta go to Slovenia now. All right. I'll see if my budget holds up.
A community approach to networking technology, yes.
Yeah.
Not always distributed, often decentralized, setting up high-speed point-to-point links.
Often chaotic.
Often chaotic, yeah. And we often have to deal with layer 8, the human layer of that is not included in the OSI networking model.
It's the full stack.
The full stack until today. Yeah, to the person sitting on a chair.
Okay, so we are done with our show for December.
Yeah, it's awesome that we could have you here on our show.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. I mean, I took up so much of your time yesterday. It's the only thing I could do.
It's all fine.
It's going to be great. I really enjoyed our conversation for my film and this one too.
Likewise.
Okay, so thank you. And we're here in the next year.
Yeah. The next show that you listen to will be, hopefully listen to, will be in January. Yeah. All right, then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thanks for tuning in.